Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest article. It's called Drinking in the Dark: Cozy Relationship Between City Administrator and Business Lobbyist Highlights Potential Conflicts of Interest Around Zenith Energy, Other Executive Functions. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. This new article of yours tackles the relationship between Deputy City Administrator Donnie Oliveira and Portland Metro Chamber Executive Vice President John Isaacs and their meeting ahead of the city's controversial Zenith decision recently. This is starting out from public records that you got. So what were you able to find?
Right, just a little bit of backstory. Street Roots has been filing for a lot of just kind of a wide variety of public records around the Zenith Energy thing and the kind of main players that are involved since early December. And, you know, one of the things with public records, they come back, you find one thing, you find another thing that leads to more requests and more records. So we have some, you know, thousands of pages around how this kind of thing has gone down, largely because environmental advocates feared that the city would try to rush through this land use statement for Zenith before the new form of government began in early January. So there's a lot of tension here, I think, around what powers the city council has versus what powers the executive branch, the mayor, and these city administrators have, that has really come to light, I think, around this Zenith thing, although it's not always directly only related to Zenith, if that makes sense. It just sort of highlights this broader issue of how, like, who has power and how decisions are being made in the new city council.
To go to the title of the piece, Drinking in the Dark, there were drinks that were involved in this. Can you tell me about that part?
Right. So people, you know, in Portland are probably largely aware and have for some time sort of feared that the Portland Metro Chamber or the Portland Business Alliance has a really outsized influence on local politics. It was much darker in the sort of bureau form of government in the past, and you know, much more of a black box. It was much more difficult to find specific things. But through these public records requests, I found that Portland Metro Chamber, one of their main lobbyists, John Isaacs, reached out to Donnie Oliveira on January 16th and said, hey, can we get drinks next Wednesday or Thursday after work? I feel urgency in this right now. And Donnie Oliveira, the deputy city administrator, who's of community and economic development, which is really handling this Zenith thing, got back, said, sounds good. I also want to get briefed on this state of economy report, whatever. They met then January 22nd at Patty's Bar downtown. And according to them, after I found this, I reached out, they said that they did talk about Zenith that night. This is the day after the city council held a work session on Zenith, in which advocates found there were quite a few false statements made. And so they did talk about this. They did talk about the clean industry hub and just some things that are very closely related to Zenith. Obviously, I wasn't there. I didn't get recordings of their, you know, meetings. It's a little creepy, but you know, they were talking about this in that day. And then just 6 days after that meeting, the Portland Metro Chamber sent an email to the mayor and City Council President Ilana Pertlegini in support of the city approving Zenith's land use statement. That was on January 28th, and these records show that Donnie Oliveira actually sent John President Pertlegini's email address. Donnie says that was after he noticed that there was an error in the email, but there's a sort of really close coordination between Donnie Oliveira, who's doing business on behalf of the executive branch of the city, John Isaacs, who's a lobbyist, you know, with the Portland Metro Chamber, and then the city council. It was 5 days later after that letter was sent that the city approved the land use statement, despite all kinds of concerns about that process.
in resolutions filed by city councilors trying to investigate this relationship as well. You were able to talk with City Council Vice President Tiffany Koyama Lane about this sort of process as well. What was her response?
Right. I heard from multiple city councilors privately that they do remain concerned about the communications that were outlined in these records. And the Metro Chamber's, you know, really outsized influence in this process. I did talk to Vice President Koyama Lane, and she said that she shares constituents' questions and concerns about this. But she's also the chair of the governance committee, which is addressing some of these longstanding issues with how power is wielded in the city. And she said she plans to bring these types of questions about this kind of process into that committee. She said it is our job as councilors to make sure that everyday Portlanders have the ability to engage in public, transparent processes that influence how our future is shaped, particularly regarding issues that affect our health and safety.
I want to ask about some of the other issues that this meeting and relationship between Deputy City Administrator Donnie Oliveira and John Isaacs from the Portland Metro Chamber, some other things that the records request that you got uncovered. One of the things that they discussed was the Clean Industry Hub. What is that? How does it relate?
One of the things about bureaucracy is that it gets really confusing. There are different names for everything, even when they're very closely related. So the Clean Industry Hub is generally based on this idea out of Denmark. It's called the Industrial Symbiosis Model. The idea is to provide a network of services that include guidance, oversight, funding, and other resources to help companies transition to cleaner sources of energy. In this case, Zenith is one of these companies. And so there's this symbiosis between the industry and the government in trying to do, sort of quote unquote, cleaner sources of fuel. This is something that, you know, we could talk about this for an hour, but gas utility adjacent nonprofits have paid for multiple trips to Denmark for public officials. That includes people at the Oregon legislature. It also includes former City Commissioner Carmen Rubio and Donnie Oliveira in 2022, went to Denmark to see how fossil fuel companies essentially propagandize in order to continue their operations and expand infrastructure for quote-unquote renewable fuels, while they can still essentially use fossil fuels, which is the concern that most environmental advocates have.
Not to layer on the confusing names like you mentioned before, but how does that relate to the Clean Industry Initiative and the Clean Industry Community Program, which also come up in your article?
Right. So the Clean Industry Initiative is this other thing that's essentially just Portland's vision for how it can do, it's like its goals, by 2050 with regard to cleaner energy, fewer carbon and reducing carbon emissions. Yes. And then on top of that, the Clean Industry Community Program, I have to look at my notes here because there are so many different names. That program is basically the Portland Clean Energy Fund granted $20 million to the Clean Industry Community Program to provide resources for large facilities and industrial businesses to invest in decarbonization, energy efficiency, renewable energy for their operations. This is partners, community program. These partners are nonprofits like Neighbors for Clean Air, but it also includes the Portland Metro Chamber's Charitable Institute and some other business groups.
Do those bodies agree with the Metro Chamber's justification for their letter supporting Zenith?
I get the sense that the Metro Chamber's letter actually just kind of blew up a few, members' emails that day, because I talked to Mary Pevedo. She's a Neighbors for Clean Air co-executive director who works on a lot of environmental issues. She said that it basically gave them an opportunity to talk about this and invoking the Clean Industry Initiative at the same time as Zenith, just sort of how everybody kind of thought about that. She said she was really uncomfortable with that association between Clean Industry Initiative and this inherent support for Zenith's land use statement, and said it felt very incongruous. She said that Clean Industry Community Program is really narrowly focused on decarbonization for industries and institutions in Portland. And then she said, I quote, It does not give blanket greenwashing to all things. So moving forward with this $20 million grant, the idea that, you know, these organizations who are closely related, working to, you know, materially address issues that lead to climate change, the idea that one of those parties, you know, who has this outsized influence in local government could send out a letter that says, because of these initiatives that we have, you need to approve this land use statement for a company that is really flying in the face of addressing climate change, you know, it's a little bit cynical, and it's a bit concerning to people who kind of understand the history of those cities and business interests, like backroom dealings.
There was another thing that Mary Pivito from Neighbors for Clean Air brought up, talking about why it is that Oregon lags behind our neighboring states when it comes to addressing carbon emissions and how renewable fuels do or don't play into that. And I think that's important to bring in here. Could you explain what she referenced?
Right. It's worth mentioning that there is a city council work session on renewable fuels on Thursday in the climate committee on Thursday morning. And I think that's a place where listeners can really learn a lot more than I'm able to say in a short interview here. But Mary Pivito and the Neighbors for Clean Air have been working at the state level to try to update large trucks that use really old technologies. Their engines are very old. And so kind of no matter what type of fuel, whether it's a bit cleaner, like renewable diesel is technically at the tailpipe, or whether it's old diesel, the kinds of emissions that are going through that old technology doesn't materially address anything. Now, part of the problem with that is that California and Washington have been so far ahead of Oregon in that they've banned these older technologies years ago. And so there are examples of Oregon literally taking, you know, at a very reduced rate, being able to buy old school buses, for instance, or old semi-trucks to use in Oregon that just came from California because they were banned because of how much carbon they were emitting into the atmosphere. And so for Neighbors for Clean Air, the idea would be that we would get rid of all of those old technologies, and that would have a much more drastic effect on carbon emissions than trying to just, you know, throw some debatably, you know, it may not even be cleaner. Renewable fuels may not even be cleaner fuels at all.
Looking at the overarching issue here, you mentioned the climate committee that meets on Thursday, but I'm curious, are there other things to mention here in this question of where things are going next?
So there is this resolution from city councilors that is about Zenith, and the general point of this is for there to be you know, far more transparency. They want to encourage open government, and it is very closely related to Zenith. It directs the mayor to open an investigation and to conduct an investigation into how this process went down, how city staff interacted around it, and whether or not it went through the quasi-judicial process that environmental advocates say it should have had. That will go into the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee on March 10th for a vote, and then it's expected to go to the full council, I believe, on March 19th. But yeah, there are things moving ahead specifically on the Zenith thing, and at the same time, just on Monday, environmental advocates, including Willamette Riverkeeper and a few other local organizations, sued the city of Portland over that process. And so there is really a lot going on, and it's very directly related to Zenith, but it is also related to how the new form of government can be more responsive to its people who elected them, and not so much to unelected deputy city administrators who may be working more on the part of the Metro Chamber than the people.
If our listeners are interested in reading this for themselves or finding out more, what do you recommend?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. And I will say, it's cold out there. People need the community to support them and purchase the paper. I also want to add that Street Roots illustrator Etta O'Donnell King did a really beautiful illustration for this newspaper, and I just think the cover is actually really kind of stand out. So it's worth purchasing. It's just $1 plus tips, and they accept cash and Venmo.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming on to talk with us about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called Drinking in the Dark: Cozy Relationship Between City Administrator and Business Lobbyist Highlights Potential Conflicts of Interest Around Zenith Energy, Other Executive Functions. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. Despite all the attention given to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's choice for Health and Human Services Secretary, many public health experts based in rural communities are focused more on the loss of healthcare infrastructure in the U.S. Ann Sosin is a public health researcher and practitioner based at Dartmouth College. KABU contributor David Rosenberg spoke with her about the country's rural healthcare infrastructure before RFK Jr.'s confirmation.
You were concerned about the infrastructure in rural healthcare, and I'm wondering if that was a problem before the new administration, and if you think that it's going to get substantially worse now.
I have long been concerned with the shrinking healthcare infrastructure in rural communities. This was a problem prior to the arrival of the Trump administration, was a problem prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Over the last several decades, we've seen rural communities lose their hospitals, their primary care facilities, their pharmacies, and other healthcare infrastructure. And what this means for rural Americans is they have increasingly diminished access to healthcare and the resources that they need to stay healthy, as well as to meet their needs when they fall ill.
What can be done about it on the state level, if anything?
So, you know, there are actions that we can take at a federal level, at a state level, and then also at a local level. These actions often are located at policy level. At policy level, there are policy choices that can be made around reimbursement, particularly for Medicaid. Many rural hospitals are serving populations that are insured or more insured by Medicaid. And so those policy choices that are made by state lawmakers have enormous bearing on the viability of rural hospitals. So that's, you know, that's one place for us to look when we're thinking about states. But I'd also add that it's really important, particularly in this moment in time, that we all, you know, work to preserve the rural health infrastructure, that we recognize how important these facilities are, not only for the health, but also for the economic survival of our rural communities. Often rural facilities are seen as expendable, and many think that rural people can just get care at larger facilities that may be located far away. And so those ideas often lead us to think that it really actually doesn't matter, that it doesn't have consequences if we do start to close facilities.
And in these confirmation hearings for RFK Jr., has the issue of rural healthcare come up at all?
So I want to say that I haven't been able to follow the confirmation hearings closely, so I'm reluctant to comment on the hearings, but access to healthcare for rural communities has not been a point of focus in the discussion around these nominees, is to my knowledge.
Is there a better approach to this in other countries, as far as you can see?
You know, certainly there are many countries that do a far better job of ensuring access to healthcare for all of their citizens than the U.S., and also that achieve better health outcomes. Even though the U.S. spends much more per capita on healthcare, it underperforms its peer countries. And so, you know, I think there's much that we can learn from the rest of the world, both in terms of how to organize our healthcare system, as well as how to deliver care to rural populations. But that's not necessarily my area of expertise. And so, you know, I guess I'll leave it at that.
So during the pandemic, there were many online appointments, and I think some people do that anyway. Is that something that rural people can do? Or even if they can, is that really inadequate?
Yeah, I think you're talking about telehealth. And we've looked at this in our own research and have seen the use of telehealth in our rural northern New England setting. And what we saw in our early pandemic research is that telehealth is a promising tool for advancing rural health equity if it's embedded within a robust existing system of care. We saw that many people were able to access specialty care using telehealth, that the option of having telehealth increased utilization of behavioral health services. In particular, it can eliminate driving time for rural residents. That said, we need to make sure that the infrastructure is in place for rural people to be able to use telehealth. Many areas have very poor broadband coverage. Rural residents may have more limited access to devices. And so addressing some of those barriers to utilizing telehealth is really important. I also want to add that when most of us think about telehealth, we're thinking about patients connecting directly with providers. In our rural region, we also see the use of telehealth to support the delivery of emergency care, and that's provider-to-provider telehealth to support remote ICU care for critically ill patients. And so there are a wide variety of applications for telehealth in the rural environment.
Are there areas in the U.S. where the rural health care is at a higher level, would you say, that other areas can learn from?
Certainly. So I would say a couple of things. First, rural is not a monolith. There's significant diversity both across and within rural places, including within our rural northern New England region. The second thing I would say is that there are some common processes that have played out across rural America and in that have affected rural places in common ways. That said, there are common challenges in terms of delivering healthcare in rural places. And there are also places that have much more in the way of health infrastructure. Here in rural northern New England, we have, I would say, more infrastructure relative to some other parts of the country. We have similar challenges in terms of the delivery of care and population health, but there is a more abundance of infrastructure in this particular region.
And with the new administration and now in power, what challenges do you see in the area of rural health care?
I have not really seen a plan for rural health or rural health care from the new administration. Certainly, there are many reasons for concern, given the track record of the former administration and some of the appointees that we're seeing come forward. But I've yet to see anything that addresses the enormous needs of rural Americans in terms of their health, or any other aspect of their lives, to be honest.
So it could be an issue that's kind of ignored or forgotten, do you think?
That is likely.
Any cause for hope or optimism in the future? Maybe there's some good, efforts, non-governmental efforts. There's community organizations that get together to provide healthcare, things like that.
So I see a lot of reasons for hope in rural places. I see the extraordinary work that's being done by rural healthcare providers, by rural organizations, by community groups. There are a lot of assets that we can build on in our rural spaces. We often hear accounts of rural America that center on things that they lack or on deficits. We hear very little about the creative and innovative work that is happening in many spaces. So that's, you know, that's a starting point. That said, there are, you know, enormous challenges, you know, facing the U.S. right now. Some of the things that we're seeing play out on the national stage are disproportionately going to impact rural people and rural places. And so we build on the strengths, but we also have to, you know, be attentive to the way that rural communities really stand to be harmed disproportionately by some of what we're witnessing right now.
Some of these communities are strong Republican areas, right? And would they then turn against the administration if their needs aren't being met? Or is that's too much of a speculative question?
So certainly the urban-rural political divide has been well documented, and that has developed over time. There's a long history behind the divide that we see between urban and rural America. And I think it's naive to think that that divide will disappear overnight and without sustained and careful action. While it's very likely that rural places will be harmed by some of the policies that are being proposed, I think we should not assume that the immediate response will be to turn against the administration or to embrace the Democratic Party. In my personal experience, I think many rural people feel invisible. They feel like their concerns are not heard or not represented by political elites in either party. There are sharp urban and rural divides. There are also class dynamics at play. And we need to listen deeply to understand kind of the source of those divides and those feelings and really think about what we can offer rural places in terms of a vision for the future, for their health, for their economic well-being, if we really want to change the current dynamics that we see.
Is there a category that you might call semi-rural, where it's kind of somewhere between suburban and rural?
So there are many definitions of rural. They're the two most common are the census and the Office of Management and Budget definition, and they measure rural places in different ways. And so different things get counted as rural under those different definitions, and that has implications for how we think of rural and we understand kind of different indicators of well-being in rural places. And so there are in some places, semi-urban or suburban areas get counted as rural, but and under other definitions, they do not. I'll also just say that, you know, rural, again, falls along a spectrum from, you know, the most remote places to larger towns that are located in more rural places. So there's not one singular definition of rural.
Yeah, I'm thinking of places, for example, in Alaska, where you could only get to by helicopter.
Yeah.
As opposed to places where you could drive to the next nearest city, although it might take you a while. Let's say you're a rural person, I don't know, in the middle of the country, and you need to go to a hospital. Are you saying the hospital might be, I don't know, 2 hours away and it might be too late to get emergency care? Is that one of the problems?
That's certainly the reality in some parts of rural America. Care may be a helicopter ride away, you know, not a short car ride away, but that's not the case everywhere. Remote rural Alaska is very different from a rural Vermont community that's not that far away from one of the region's academic medical centers.
Speaking of Vermont, has Bernie Sanders brought the issue up or any other representative from there?
Bernie Sanders has devoted a lot of attention to strengthening the infrastructure of federally qualified health centers or FQHCs and is obviously, as someone from Vermont, very interested in rural healthcare.
Anything else you want to add to what you've said?
So I guess just, you know, given the moment that we're in, you know, maybe I could speak to kind of the feelings of rural people around this particular moment and what we're seeing happening right now. You know, there's been a lot of attention on the rise of RFK and, you know, other extreme figures at this particular moment. And many people see rural places as having often particularly fertile terrain for RFK and his ideas. And I want us to critically interrogate some of those ideas and to really understand or at least explore the social, cultural, and economic conditions that have created a receptive audience for RFK and others in rural places, and also to think about kind of the political economy that has fueled the rise of some of these figures. We've seen enormous resources invested in undermining public health and public health tools and in pushing out disinformation and misinformation to rural and other places. And so we have to make sense of, you know, a very complex moment. And it's very easy to resort to kind of easy explanations of what we're seeing in the political sphere right now. And so I'd really invite listeners to embrace kind of the complexity, to spend time with some of the work that's been done by scholars in rural places to understand what we're seeing right now, and to really spend some time listening to what rural people have to say about their lives and their hopes for the future
That's public health researcher Anne Sosin speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. Thanks for being with us.
Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about